You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko te ora toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wai mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Arpa Wednesday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. Fi Akane coming up on today's show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the government's downgrade of methane targets, the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, and the country's oceans warming 34% faster than the global average. I spoke to Ritesh Shah, a senior lecturer in critical studies and education and the co-director of the Centre for Asia-Pacific Refugee Studies at the University of Auckland, about the most recent ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel and whether it will stick. Tuesday Y host Sarah also attended the Auckland Central World Homeless Day event on Friday last week and spoke with LifeWise director Pam Elger. Manny, what do you have for us today?
For this week's Get Action, I speak to the chair of the public issues, chair of public issues for the Association of Psychotherapists, Wick Willamette, on the open letter for mental health professionals calling on the New Zealand government to act on Palestine. I also speak to chief executive of Retail New Zealand, Caroline Young, about the government's plans to ban stores passing on contactless paywave fees.
He aho whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Te kapato himaya text in on 5395. Kaua e ware ware, e ahei na koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrerono. Hei pakihiri rokuroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM i te katikom. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95bfm.com. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Earlier this week, the government announced science-based biogenic methane targets for 2050 in what they say will provide farmers and exporters with a clear pathway to reduce emissions while maintaining productivity and trade competitiveness. Following Cabinet's approval, the target will be set at a range of 14 to 24% below 2017 levels by 2050, reflecting the findings of the Independent Methane Science Review released in 2024. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez-March about this topic. We also discussed the most recent ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, and recent findings from the Ministry for the Environment and Stats New Zealand showing Aotearoa's oceans are warming 34% faster than the global average. But first, we discussed the government's changes to methane targets. What was the Green Party's reaction to these methane targets announced by the government?
Weakening our climate targets is nothing short of climate nihilism. Farmers are actually some of the most affected by climate change. And we have seen report after report that the impacts of climate change and the ways of more frequent extreme weather events will cost our communities and our economies greatly. The government should instead put in place funding to support farmers transition into more regenerative practices, so that we can actually have access to food and support farmers to not be so impacted by climate change.
Green Party co-leader Klaus Warbrick called this announcement a cheap accounting trick. Why has she made this claim?
Basically because the way that the government has calculated the methane targets allows them to A, give themselves a range, B, also because effectively what the government is doing is claiming that they'll just make up for it elsewhere, but we're also seeing that the government is also not serious about climate change in other parts of the economies and with other emissions, and so we're also concerned that the government is presenting this as evidence-based when, you know, the idea of no additional warming is not grounded in evidence. It's actually part of climate nihilism rhetoric, because at the end of the day, what we need to do is reduce emissions, not just aim for no additional warming.
You mentioned farmers, and I guess extending on that, how will this policy affect rural communities?
Well, in the medium term, the risk is that we're leaving farmers more exposed to extreme weather events, to changes in weather patterns, which in and of itself will affect yields and crops. And this is why, instead, what the Greens have campaigned on for a few years now is to have a fund that allows farmers to transition into more regenerative, lower emission practices that actually can still produce high value exports that are good for farmers and our overall economy.
Moving on to our next topic, a ceasefire deal has been reached in Gaza. Yesterday, we learned that Israel has started releasing Palestinian prisoners, while Hamas has released the remaining hostages. What is your reaction to the current ceasefire agreement and the release of hostages by Hamas and the release of these 2,000 Palestinian prisoners?
Israel has a poor track record of abiding by previous ceasefire agreements, and unfortunately, in the past about 12 hours, we have seen how Israel has already reportedly killed people in Gaza in spite of the ceasefire. The key thing here moving forward will also be that any peace plan will need to guarantee Palestinians their sovereignty. Palestine must remain for Palestinians, and any attempt to move technocrats to take over parts of the governing of Gaza risks taking control of Gaza away from Palestinians. Also, the key issue is that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories has not ended, and Israel must also be held to account for the genocide they have committed.
US President Donald Trump has called for a full pardon for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. How does the Green Party respond to that?
Oh, that's a very Trump move, someone who provided weapons and aided Netanyahu in carrying out the genocide that we saw in Gaza. Of course, he would be then seeking to pardon Netanyahu for the war crimes that he has committed. Israel and Netanyahu are yet to face accountability for the genocide and the war crimes that they have committed. And, you know, this is why there's not going to be peace unless there's justice. Parties that have been complicit in a genocide must be held to account, and we reject any idea of having any form of pardon for Netanyahu.
You mentioned that part of the ceasefire may have already broken. There are reports that 9 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers since this ceasefire deal. What needs to happen? What role can New Zealand play here for a ceasefire to stick?
Well, it goes beyond the ceasefire, right? It's about the government putting enough pressure on Israel to comply with the ceasefire agreement. It's also about working towards peace via justice. The government has yet to join the ICJ case to take Israel to basically the court that will hold them accountable for the genocide and the war crimes that they have committed. And we are yet to sanction people who continue defending and celebrating a genocide that was happening right in front of our eyes and being live streamed on our screen. So in order for there to be long-standing peace, there must also be justice. And this is why without justice, the ceasefire will remain extremely fragile, because we're still seeing violence and occupation happening for Palestinians who are living in Gaza.
Lastly, the Ministry of the Environment and Stats New Zealand's 3-yearly update has revealed that Aotearoa's oceans are warming 34% faster than the global average, with $180 billion worth of housing as well as $26 billion worth of infrastructure at risk of flooding. What was the Green Party's reaction to this news?
It's really concerning, and it confirms the fears that we have had that communities across Aotearoa will be put at risk of climate change and the subsequent weather changes that will come from warming oceans. So, for example, we're talking about coastal communities facing their homes being destroyed. We're talking about parts of our economies being extremely disrupted, and also ecological collapse as a result of many of our natural ecosystems not being able to sustain themselves as our oceans warm. So this is an alarming report, and if anything, it should be a wake-up call for our climate denialist government. But more needs to be done to address climate change, to pressure other global players to do the part, but for us to also take a leading role in transitioning our economy to one that is low emission, and that actually could also help lower the cost of living, investment into things like electrified rail that is affordable and connects our communities is climate action. And so there's no reason why the government can't tackle warming oceans, the climate crisis, and the cost of living all at once. It's all connected.
As mentioned previously, the government has come under questioning about other climate-related policies. Do you think the government is taking the threat to our climate notion seriously enough?
Absolutely not. They have talked about bringing back oil and gas exploration, spouted lies about the economic benefits of such exploration when we have seen that, despite what the government may say, the government has not found new oil and gas in quite some time. And it's also threatening to mine in conservation areas that are key hotspots for our ecosystems, that also allows those ecosystems to absorb carbon emissions. And so this government, if anything, is putting particularly coastal communities at risk, farmers at risk. And, you know, for communities like us in Auckland that faced the impacts of extreme flooding events in 2023, we could be seeing those events happening a lot more frequently if the government doesn't take action.
And how should the government take action to protect those aforementioned communities and infrastructure that are affected, that would be affected by these findings?
One of the things that the government could do is better support councils to ensure that we have infrastructure that works with nature as opposed to against it. So, for example, restoring our streams in places like Auckland allows our cities to better absorb extreme weather events. But also it's about having the infrastructure that is resilient, so that it's greater investment into things like rail, so that we can move away from carrying our freight in roads, and also to connect our towns and cities by rail, which the government continues lagging behind when it comes to its investment in those areas. Those are all things that make people's lives cheaper, but also reduces emissions.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the government's downgrade in methane targets, the most recent ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, and New Zealand's oceans warming up 34% faster than the global average.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
Over this week, we've seen the most promising developments yet towards a de-escalation in Palestine, with international dialogue leading to a ceasefire, exchanges of hostages, and plans to establish a new governing body in Gaza. Yet, the long-term trauma created by conflict often perpetuates instability, creating a circle of violence and escalation. With no plan materializing yet for ending Israeli occupation of the West Bank, nor for pursuing justice for the crimes committed in this conflict, huge questions hang over the future of Palestine and Israel. For this week's Get Action, I speak to the Chair of Public Issues for the Association of Psychotherapists, Rick Willimond, on his open letter from the mental health professionals calling on the New Zealand government to act on Palestine. What motivated you to focus on this issue?
I'm a citizen deeply concerned about the genocide that unfolded in Gaza particularly, but also with the treatment of Palestine by Israel and by the US and by European countries, Canada, and the New Zealand government complicity in basically turning a blind eye to profound human suffering, which is morally repugnant and enraged. Yeah, I feel enraged by that. So that's basically what motivated me as a mental health professional dealing with people who have experienced trauma on all sorts of levels in their life. And I've been doing that work for decades. So I have this understanding that comes from my work of the profound ongoing impact of war. And I don't really believe that what we've been witnessing is a war. Anyway, to call it a war for convenience, the mental health effect on Palestinians is profound and will be profound for generations to come. So I feel very strongly about that. I wanted to offer a means for my colleagues in the mental health profession to have a voice and to use our understanding of trauma and the impact of trauma across generations to appeal to our leaders' conscience and compassion and to ask for a much stronger stance against Israel. That's kind of the heart of it. there's some secondary motivations there as well. There's also a moral injury that we all suffer, as I see it, from being witness to profound injustice and also to our leaders being so passive and enabling. And in our name, you know, a speech is given at the United Nations, which basically justifies taking this passive, complicit position. And we are watching on our phones the decimation of a people, live stream genocide, bombing of hospitals, murder of aid workers, murder of journalists, starvation as a tool of war, weaponization of food. It's repugnant, and we're forced to watch it and watch the world order do nothing, even though the International Criminal Court has declared that war crimes have been committed, that crimes against humanity have been committed, and then more recently, you know, Amnesty International has come out, and a number of other Medicine Sans Frontières and Israeli human rights groups as well. And now these 600 genocide scholars have said this is a genocide. So there's moral injury. That's my point to all of us. So it's very important that we don't just sit and accept gross injustice. This is a profound injustice and it's preventable. And the world order is saying, we'll accept it. It's disgusting.
Right. So it's both the concern for the long-term impacts of the conflict and genocide on Palestinians, but also the complicity and how that impacts people here.
Yeah. That's right. And I want to weave in here, there's a very real issue for people living in Israel. They have been living with fear and they have been attacked by Hamas. You know, there were 800 civilians in that attack on October, and hundreds of people have died, been murdered at the hands of Hamas. They're not innocent, and there is real fear and real trauma in Israel as well. And so I don't want to say Hamas is blameless. They're not. But the gross injustice, you have a very powerful military force, highly sophisticated, funded by the US and others, and what they have done in the name of combating terrorism is kill tens of thousands of children and women and elderly. And it's disgusting. The mental health effects are obviously where I focus.
As the conflict changes and moves, there's been, you know, hostages and captives released, almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners from Israel and the last remaining people taken on October 7th, both released. As the conflict moves and potentially cools down, what would you like to see going forward?
It seems so important that Palestinians are supported to have autonomy over their own land and that they're supported to rebuild their lives. It's so easy for me to say that. I mean, it's a monumental task. Their homes are in rubble. Their beloved family are murdered and maimed. It's just profound trauma that will reverberate through Palestine and actually reverberates in the heart of every compassionate person. So it's a tremendous lesson to us all about what's important. And it's a shocking moment for all of us too. The moral injury is profound. What faith that we had in institutions like the UN are just shaken by this. They've spoken out and been completely toothless. So I don't have any simple answers to that. I hope that Aotearoa moves away from it, push to the right, certainly with the current crowd. How do we rebuild compassionate societies out of the mess that we have? You know, the threats on all levels are so obvious to anyone that's paying attention in terms of ecological destruction, not limited to climate change, but very much including the imminent threat of that and biodiversity loss and the geopolitical mess. It's threats on every level. And I worry for future generations wherever on the globe, definitely in Aotearoa, we're more isolated, less populated, it's relatively politically stable. We have tremendous privilege here. The threats are enormous. So I think about those things constantly. And those of us that are aware of these things need to come together and be concerned together, and we need to grieve together, and we need to strategize together. We need to form alliances together. And I know all of that's already happening. We need to do a lot more of that. And my profession needs to be part of that. Like, we are skilled in tending to traumatic injury. We're skilled at processing emotion. We're skilled in managing conflict. My profession needs to step up out of the rabbit hole of individual complexity and start thinking more systemically and working more systemically. These issues are very, very important to me. Understanding of dysfunction, of the impact of trauma, and hopefully we've done enough in terms of our own awareness of colonization that we can offer support to people, because we're entering troubled times. We're in troubled times, that's for sure.
That was Rick Willimont, Chair of Public Issues for the Association of Psychotherapists, on the open letter from mental health professionals calling on the government to act on Palestine. You can sign this open letter by going to our.actionstation.org.nz/petitions/openlettermentalhealthforpalestine. We'll include a link on the podcasted recording of this show on the 95BFM website.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Whoa, I've never seen so many colours come out of someone's mouth before.
There's more where that came from.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. And if you want to see all the colours of the rainbow in one room erupting in wondrous sonic performance, then tune into 95BFM Breakfast all week, because we've got tickets to give away to the opening night.
The Exploding Rainbow Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets available from Mushtix.
You know how everyone has a day one? Like, day one at uni, day one of their first job.
Yeah, why?
Well, these filmmakers, they're having their day one. Day one shorts. 8 films from local directors getting their first big break.
What kind of stories?
All sorts. Fertility, ballroom, sweaty hands, even a corporate monster crash out.
Sounds like a bit of me.
All free to watch on YouTube, RNZ and Multi Plus.
I'm checking them out tonight.
Day one shorts. New voices, bold stories. Stream now.
Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mash downs, candid conversation, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
Well, I was escaping reality of my own creating. Living.
Safe Street by Sentient Mud. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-309-3879.
Do you think we'll continue to see these actions from Trump throughout the rest of his presidency?
Who knows what Trump is going to do?
The Wire.
Following on from my chat with MP Ricardo Menendez March earlier, I spoke with Ritesh Shaw, a senior lecturer in critical studies and education and the co-director of the Centre for Asia Pacific Refugee Studies at the University of Auckland, about the most recent ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel. This comes following reports of Israeli soldiers having shot and killed 9 Palestinians returning to their homes following the ceasefire. US President Donald Trump has warned that if Hamas do not disarm, the US will disarm them. I spoke to Shah about this topic and whether the ceasefire will stick. What did you make of this development?
I mean, it's a positive development in the sense that you can see that both sides have effectively honored the first step of the 20-point plan. And in many ways, that was the first critical step. But as many commentators have noted, that is in fact the low-hanging fruit. The next questions are about what comes next and how long such a peace can be sustained for.
Why are we seeing this iteration of a ceasefire now, and how is it different compared to the prior ceasefires we've seen in the Israel-Gaza conflict?
I think it's probably a confluence of a number of factors. I think the Trump administration was reading the international pulse and realizing that increasingly Israel was being isolated, that it was kind of going rogue in terms of some of its actions. And I think the United States wanted to show leadership on this. Of course, there are also the personal interests of Donald Trump to have a role in claiming that he resolved this conflict. And I think that those interests have kind of very much driven pressure on the Netanyahu government to accept a ceasefire after effectively saying no several times to the same terms in the past.
We've seen a lot of discussion around the 20 living Israeli hostages that have been released by Hamas, but what do we know about the 2,000 Palestinians, 1,700 of whom were seized during the war and held without charge, being released from Israeli prisons?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question, isn't it, that the media coverage has very much focused on those 20 hostages. But yes, the situation for those 1,700 who were illegally detained for long periods of time has largely been ignored. And some of the reports that are coming out from those hostages who have since been released are that they really were kept in inhumane conditions that would contravene international human rights law, where, you know, they were tortured, where they were denied water and food, and basically, you know, also denied any sort of legal representation. There's also, of course, the other Palestinian prisoners, some who were deemed security threats for life, who have been released as well. And again, you know, many of those people who are released are children. And so there's not a lot of attention to the impacts that kind of long period of detention that's had on these young boys mainly.
According to Yosef Bezate, an economics professor at the University of Bezate, the cost to rebuild Gaza will be far greater than the estimated $50 billion, or roughly 87 billion New Zealand dollars, which was calculated by the United Nations. Who should be responsible for funding the reconstruction of Gaza?
That's a great question. That hasn't been actually answered fully yet. I think that the Trump administration has said privately that they think Israel should bear some of the costs for that. But Israel has not actually said that they will. Many are expecting that the responsibility and burden will then fall primarily on the Gulf states. In past reconstruction efforts, Qatar has played a really significant role in the reconstruction of Gaza from prior conflicts. I imagine that they'll be called on again, probably Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf countries as well. And the United States will, as it has in the past, also chip in. But, you know, it's one thing I want to point out here is that we've seen this countless times before. Gaza has been under siege since 2007. There have been at least six other escalations, none of this intensity and scale. And every time there is a reconstruction process that follows, and then 3 or 4 years later, you see another escalation. So I think one of the concerns that I have at the moment is that what we're observing now is a return to the status quo, probably a worse status quo than existed prior. And this is what Johann Galtung calls a negative peace, because it's really just about the absence of violence. But it's actually not addressing some of the root causes that have led to this ongoing conflict in the first place.
We'll touch on that a little bit later on, but firstly, yesterday US President Donald Trump spoke about Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He said that he really likes him and described him as a great wartime leader. This is despite the International Criminal Court, or ICC, having issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu almost a year ago now, with charges stemming from, and I'm quoting the ICC directly here, being allegedly responsible for the war crimes of starvation as a method of warfare and of intentionally directing an attack against the civilian population, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts from at least the 8th of October 2023 until at least the 20th of May 2024. With how Trump has described Netanyahu here, are you concerned about what this sort of sentiment means heading forward?
I think many in the world wouldn't be surprised to hear something like that come out of the mouth of Donald Trump. He's also praised Vladimir Putin on occasion, flattered him, and other kind of questionable world leaders. You know, he is obviously engaging in an act of flattery, and we see that Trump does that whenever he wants to kind of win over people. And so I think that's exactly what he's done, and he sees Netanyahu as one of his strongest allies.
Trump has hailed these talks and the current ceasefire agreement as the end of the Gaza war. We've recently seen this morning Israeli soldiers kill at least 9 Palestinians returning to their homes in northern Gaza City and southern Khan Yunis, according to Al Jazeera. How confident are you that the ceasefire will stick?
In the short term, I would say confident that it will stick for now. I think there's a lot of pressure both from within Israel and from the international community for this conflict to end for now. I think the long-term prospects are pretty grim, as I've already noted. What we're seeing is effectively a negative peace. There's also the fact that in the 20-point plan, there's really no discussion of what's happening in the West Bank. So this is very much focused on what's happening in the Gaza Strip at the moment, but not anything to do with Israel's ongoing annexation of lands in the Gaza Strip, in the West Bank, and the kind of promotion of settlements there. So I think what we will see is probably a period of some peace or absence of violence. But I do not think that we will see a long-term peace settlement come out of it.
That was the University of Auckland's Ritesh Shaw on the most recent ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas and whether he believes it will stick.
I don't know how to say this. Bitterly goose star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Beetlejuice.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
The cost of living in New Zealand has been one of Kiwi's top reported issues since it topped polls at the end of the COVID lockdowns, prompting the National Party in opposition at the time to declare a cost of living crisis. However, the now national-led government is receiving pushback for reforms of contactless payments that critics say will increase prices. The government says they are removing an annoyance for consumers, but stores say banning their ability to pass on the costs contactless payment fees to consumers will mean that they have to back these fees onto the original price, meaning everyone, not just those paying with contactless, will bear the costs. To learn more about this, I speak to Chief Executive of Retail New Zealand, Caroline Young, about how the government's plans will impact consumers.
I want to start off with the perspective of the retail community. From the perspective of a retailer, a shopkeeper, a store manager, what will the scrapping of these fees practically mean?
Well, the surcharge ban, there's a range of things. Firstly, you know, our members have widely told us that they don't agree with the proposed surcharge ban for a number of reasons. One is they believe that the marketplace is working fine now. Retailers have the ability to charge or not to charge a surcharge, and not all retailers do charge. Currently, around 44% of retailers are charging a surcharge. And consumers can have the choice. They can choose to pay by cash, they can pay by FPOS, they can insert a debit card. If they do any of those three things, they don't incur a fee. And if they pay by contactless, they'll incur a fee, and that's widely acknowledged and recognised. So there's no surprises there, and the consumer can also choose to shop at a different store. Very much similar if a business doesn't take cash, you may choose to continue to go to that premises and pay by an electronic transaction, or you may choose to go somewhere else that takes cash. So consumers have choice. As soon as you remove the surcharge, you are removing choice for consumers, because the majority of businesses will put up prices. Then it becomes non-transparent to consumers and everyone suffers. So it means that if you're paying by FPOS or cash, you're paying a higher price and subsidising those that are paying from more expensive models. And it is also a very complex system. One of the things you'll do if you read the regulatory impact statement that was submitted to Cabinet, MB talks about the fact right through the paper that they haven't done any consultation. But they also talk about the fact that the financial payment system, the retail payment system, is the most used financial service in New Zealand. And there's been no consultation about this change. And what we do know is the merchant service fee, which is the fee that retailers pay to have an electronic transaction go through their store, is a very, very complex and difficult system for businesses to understand. So, you know, there's no way that just actually making an announcement without any consultation with people that are using the system, whether it's a bank or whether it's a credit card company or whether it's a different acquirer or whether it's a terminal provider or a retailer or a hospitality business, there are a number of unintended consequences that will happen. And I think the key thing is that we're going to see prices rise, which is the opposite of what government are looking for. They're looking for economic growth. They're looking to temper inflation. Price rises are inflationary. So, you know, straight away, they're actually not meeting the needs that they want them to meet.
Speaking to the government's intentions, do you believe this is simply misguided policy? Do you buy the government's logic that they've put out there, or could there be some logic behind this decision, or do you just don't buy it at all?
No, we don't agree with the minister's decision. We're actually meeting with him today to have a further discussion about it. But fundamentally, you know, we're driven by our members, and the research that we've done and the surveys we've had and the consultation we've done with our members, the feedback's overwhelming that they are completely against the surcharge ban because of the fact it takes away choice both for consumers and for retailers.
You talked about that merchant trader fee and these sort of difficult processes that go into this. The adjustment to changing this policy, is that a big process, or is it going to be smaller than you might think?
Yeah, look, it depends. So it depends how it's set up on your system. Some retailers have had specific software built into the terminal to facilitate transactions in their store in a way they want them to happen. Others have taken a off-the-shelf model. So depending on which way you've gone, it can be more complex than others. Whilst it might seem easy just to turn it off, it's not as easy and straightforward as just turning it off for some retailers, because they've put in place some really quite sophisticated solutions.
So it might mess with people's Baroque solutions, their unique ones that they've used, and it's taking away the freedom of businesses to handle this themselves.
It's absolutely. And people, when they've put in place a bespoke solution in terms of how the transactions flow through their terminal, they've actually invested thousands of dollars for that to happen. And normally what would happen, as your listeners will be aware, is that that capital cost will be spread out over a number of years. Now, that's not going to happen in these circumstances because, obviously, the surcharge ban, you know, the Minister and the Prime Minister have indicated that they want to, you know, come into effect almost immediately that the legislation is passed, if it passes. So, yeah, it will be challenging for sure. I'll just tell you a couple of other things that your listeners may be interested.
Yes.
We completed a survey, and in our submission to government, we included a number of quotes. And one of the constant factors that's come up is that, you know, government's always talking about competition. And one of the things that we know that this will occur is that you're going to have less competition because more and more transactions will go through the Visa and MasterCard switch. So the people that are going to benefit are Visa and MasterCard. They're going to have greater profits than they already have. They're going to embed the duopoly and make that stronger. And it's going to be really hard for fintechs and other parties to come in and disrupt the current system and have an opportunity to, you know, provide different solutions. You know, the Visa and the MasterCard schemes are really big international companies, and they have a lot of resources and technology and behind them that can just dominate the marketplace. And our members are really concerned that it feels like the government's stance is certainly backing international banks and credit card companies over local retailers.
I've also seen it thrown out that part of the logic behind this perhaps is to smooth the point of purchase, to make that a quicker process, which PayWave and contactless was always intended to be, and the removal of these surcharges and fees will make it easier for people who might be a little less responsible with their money to continue that process and increase the rate of transactions, and we know that's good for markets like GDP. Do you believe it could be something like that, or would you not buy that?
Once again, it depends. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all. If you're in a business like a supermarket or the warehouse or a Kmart where you've got a high volume of consumers coming through your store at a rapid rate, you know, speed of transaction is important, and getting people through the till is really important. In smaller stores, you know, customer service is a critical component to retail. And so engaging with your customers and talking to them, and not necessarily, it doesn't have to be an expedient process at the till. So it depends on the model that you're looking at. If you're a smaller store, you need to make sure that you've got a good engagement with your customers. You're going to get them to come back. You'll be asking them about whether they want to sign up to your loyalty program, if they already are a loyalty member. You know, some of the smaller boutiques wrap things really special and all of that sort of thing. It's not necessarily about speed for every store, and I think it's about making sure that you're not thinking that one blanket answer suits everyone, together with the fact that economically we know that the data tells us that people that have a lower income and are more economically disadvantaged as a higher percentage use cash and FPOS, and they will be disadvantaged by prices increasing. So this doesn't help those that are in a more difficult financial position, you know, by removing the surcharge. So I really think there's a lot more work that needs to be done in this, and we are calling for the government to pause their proposed ban.
Caroline Young, thank you very much.
That was Chief Executive of Retail New Zealand, Caroline Young, speaking on the government's plans to ban contactless payment fees that will impact retailers and consumers.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Did you know I can claim the dreamer from the dream? Make it feel everything you've never even seen. Yeah, it's been a long, a long, a long, a long, a long, long.
Christoph Altruinto is playing The Other's Way, Saturday, November 29, presented by 95BFM.
Altruinto is a dangerous man.
That was Wednesday Afternoon by Christoph L. Trento. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
On Friday last week, a range of organisations who provide services to the homeless population in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland, and across Aotearoa came together for a World Homeless Day event in the CBD. Tuesday Wire host Sarah attended the event and spoke with LifeWise Executive Chair Pam Elgar about the kaupapa of the day.
Well, World Homeless Day is a day where we can celebrate and actually be at one and support the homeless in the city. So we've invited everyone down to St Patrick's Square to come and join the festivities, to have some free kai, to actually look at the stalls and the support mechanisms around and just generally chill out and talk in a safe way. So some of the stores, we've got Sunday Blessings, they provide food. We've got LifeWise Food by Merge is also here. Auckland City Mission, Kāinga Ora to Matawai, Whānau Art Exhibition, Orange Sky, Akarana Māori Wardens are supporting us as they do for many, many events in Tamaki Makaurau and beyond. The Court of New Beginnings is also here, which is wonderful. We've got Rapid Relief Team Global offering delicious burgers, Kickback, the Hare National Health Coalition, the Auckland City Mission Grocer, Vision West, Auckland Against Poverty, Whare Tikaki, Papai Te Haora, and Fair Food with breakfast packs.
In your mahi, how have you observed the rise of homelessness or the prevalence of homelessness, especially in Auckland, but also across Aotearoa?
Well, unfortunately, homelessness is growing, and we see that with the complexity of the cases that we deal with. We see that in the numbers on the street. And most recently, Heart of the City Chief Executive, Viv Beck, shared survey results that business owners and office workers believe homelessness, a shortage of police, and neglect and disorder are crippling the city's heart. And that may be what the business people are experiencing. But behind all of that, these are people. They're our street whānau. They're family members. They're facing daily struggles compounded by mental health issues, addiction, and a dire lack of safe housing and accommodation. So what they need is holistic support.
How have the current government's recent policy decisions influenced or contributed to the problem of homelessness?
Look, the National Coalition government unfortunately have provided really damaging and quite judgmental style policies that lack any hope. Aotearoa is a very small country and we pride ourselves as being people who provide manaakitanga, who really epitomise a sense of belonging. Unfortunately, the policies that are currently being rolled out actually say only some people belong, only some people are worthy. The rest of you need to get off your backside and actually do stuff. And I found the recent policy around 18 and 19 year olds needing to go off job seeker and for the appearance with a threshold of 65,000 being so pejorative, it's ridiculous.
Do you think that those kinds of decisions paint the wrong picture about the root causes of homelessness?
I think, and this isn't just National Party, this is all political parties. It's expedient for political parties to have wonderful sound bites, but actually complex issues need complex solutions. Going for the simplistic answer is only going to do a part of the job. Housing is one of the issues that the government's doing a lot of work on, and thank you for that. That's fantastic. It's really positive, the work that's being done in housing. However, the homeless aren't just single people who need single one style of property. They're a whānau that need to be housed together, and when you're only building one or two bedroom properties, when you need properties that suit multi-generation houses, then you're only looking at simplistically again. So we need the mix of housing in the areas that the homeless are actually congregated, where there's space for them to do. And multi-generational housing needs to be built and catered for.
I see that we've got quite a big network of organisations here, and it demonstrates that this problem isn't just about getting people into a house, it's about making sure that they have access to clothes and haircuts and food and the community. I think that's the main important thing. Are there any other gaps that you would identify in the funding or the support that is available in this country?
So what I think we really need is a systemic whole of government policy settings approach to reducing homelessness. So every government department has a KPI to reduce homelessness. We need a bipartisan approach to the homelessness crisis. We need a national homelessness plan that absolutely everybody can understand and articulate.
What role would you like to see from the community or the public in order to see an improvement in, I guess, statistics around homelessness?
For the public, could you please just recognise that the person lying asleep in the doorway is a person, first and foremost. Say kia ora, say hello, how are you? Greet them as if they're a genuine person, allow them dignity, because they're someone's sister, they're someone's brother, they're someone's uncle, they're someone's aunt, they're someone's dad, they're someone's grandparent. Please, as every individual can give away a smile. If you do that, then that will become a more welcoming and generous society. So let's just do the thing that we can do. Donate to the organisations that are helping and actually just treat them as individuals and say hi.
That was LifeWise Executive Chair Pam Elger on World Homeless Day last week, speaking to Tuesday Wire host Sarah.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, the Association of Psychotherapists, Rick Willamant, University of Auckland's Ritesh Shaw, Retail New Zealand's Carolyn Young, and LifeWise's Pam Elger. Nei ra hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.